Well, hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Mandy Self, and we are going to be discussing Orson Scott Card's Speaker for the Dead, which won the Hugo Award in 1987. So, Mandy, thanks for joining me.
I'm glad to be here.
I have now completed the, it's not a trifecta because there's only two of you.
A duo, I guess.
There we go. Yes, and completed the pairing. There we go. With having had Michael on to discuss Dune and now having you on. Now, normally I would probably start by asking you about your other podcasting endeavors, but we've kind of already gotten the history of Trivially Crucial from Michael, so we don't have to retread that necessarily, but maybe we could kind of focus on just more about you, sort of what is your geeky history. Myself, I'm kind of more of an adult convert to nerdism. I've gotten more into science fiction and that kind of stuff as I've gotten older, but I came to it kind of late, so I'm curious what your history is like.
Well, I'm a second generation geek, a geek raised by geeks. So there's a lot of stuff that I honestly cannot remember my first exposure to. Star Wars, I have no idea the first time I saw Star Wars. Terminator, yeah. I have no idea. Star Trek, you know, The Next Generation came on television the year I was born. So I'm pretty sure I watched it from birth. Mm-hmm. So geeky things were just always a part of my family. It was just the way we lived. Like, we went and saw... If we went to the movies, it was pretty much either Disney movies or geeky movies. And there were certain coming of age things that were like, you must now read this book or see this movie. Like the one I always like tells in the second grade, my mom decided it was time to watch Alien, which went well for me, but not for my little sister. We did an Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3 marathon. Then in fourth grade, my mom handed me The Hobbit and A Wrinkle in Time and was like, it is now time for you to read these. And then, mm-hmm. of course, in the seventh grade, my dad gave me Ender's Game, which is kind of how we end up here on this podcast.
Right.
So, very influenced by my parents, though there's some stuff I discovered on my own, like Asimov. My parents weren't super familiar. They had read him, but they didn't love him. I go to cons and I take my parents with me. So nice. My parents actually know Michael pretty well too through all of this. Second generation geek. I come from the geek world and lineage.
Nice. Geek and proud.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned, you know, we don't necessarily need to do a rundown of how Trivially Crucial came to be, but maybe just kind of a quick elevator pitch. What's it all about?
Trivially Crucial is basically a podcast where my friend Michael and I talk about the importance of different stories that we love and how they've had an impact things like that. We like to take things apart with love. I always like to use Thor as my example, though I don't think we've done a podcast devoted to Thor. But
you have referenced it a number of times,
though. Yeah, I love the movie Thor. I can tear it to shreds, but I love
do too.
It.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. It's an irrational love, I know.
Yeah, so for us, you know, being able to deconstruct something doesn't make us love it less.
Right.
So that's something we just really enjoy doing and talking about. So yeah, that's kind of Trivially Crucial.
Cool. I'll make sure to put in the show notes a link to your episode on Ender's Game, because
yes,
that's a great kind of refresher, I think, because you basically walk through the plot. And
yeah, I love Ender's Game, so it's kind of like Mandy lectures Michael on Ender's Game, but
yeah. It did seem like you were the one who had more experience with it. And it was an important one for me too, because when I was kind of trying to start reading more science fiction, Ender's Game was one that was recommended to me a number of times. And then I think I was at a friend's house and he's like, oh yeah, I've got Ender's Game here. Why don't you just take it home with you? And, you know, and here we are, like you said.
Yeah, it's funny for me because my dad gave me Ender's Game in the seventh grade, but I didn't read it till eighth because, you know, despite being a geek raised by geeks, you know, when your dad recommends a book to you, it surely cannot be as cool as mm-hmm. real books, right? So he gave it to me in the seventh grade, but it sat on my shelf for a year until I read it. And then I was like, oh, maybe dad's on to something.
Yeah, this is one I actually got my dad onto before he passed away. So he was a big fan of it, too.
Yeah, Ender's Game is one of those books I tend to throw at people, and I'm like, read this. Speaker for the Dead, I tend to be a little more cautious with, but we'll talk about that, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think so. So back to general nerdery and stuff. One of the questions that I kind of sent you was if you would tally up how many of the Hugo winners you've read.
So I looked over it, and I think it's 10, but that's a soft 10 of there are 10 that I recall reading. Okay. I own more of the than 10, and I may have read them and just like banished them from my mind, or I may have never read them. But I've definitely read 10.
Okay. Well, I think this is the first case where I've read more than anyone else. So,
well, I hate Heinlein, so that kind of knocks out a whole
That bunch. Knocks out most of the 50s and 60s.
So, yeah. And every time I look at the list and I'm like, I should read Hugo books, and then I see Heinlein and I'm like, no.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I actually enjoy Robert Heinlein, but well, at least what I've read of him, and it's mostly short fiction and Starship Troopers. But the reason that I'm not going through in order is just to avoid that problem where I get stuck with stuff that is very of its time, which can be delightful, but if it's all of its time, you know, in 50s and 60s science fiction, I'm not sure that I would enjoy reading it through in order. And so that's why I wanted to just kind of, you know what, let the guest pick the topic, and eventually I will have to start asking people to cover, you know, Double Star and some of that other stuff.
Yeah.
It's probably a good idea before we get really anywhere in this discussion, just to warn people, there's no way that we're going to be able to have even a non-spoiler discussion about Speaker for the Dead without spoiling major plot points of Ender's Game.
Yeah.
So if you have not read that, you know, like Mandy said, this is a book that nerds tend to throw at other people and say, this is a good introduction to a science fiction book. So if you haven't read it, do yourself a favor. Go read it. It doesn't, you know, you can read it in a day or over a weekend. It's a great summer read because, yeah, the setup for Speaker for the Dead is Ender's Game. And so there's no way we're going to be able to discuss it without spoiling something in it. And you owe it to yourself, too. Yeah, at least watch the movie, maybe.
No.
Yeah, I guess that's a tough recommend.
Don't watch the movie, please. Yeah. Read the book. It doesn't take that long to read, I promise.
That's true. I was trying to give people a shortcut, but I think it's too much of a shortcut. And I do want to circle back to that and talk about later with Speaker for the Dead if we think it'd be possible to adapt it to film. But that's something for further on down, if I remember it. So when I first brought up the idea for this podcast on the Incomparable Slack for the Supergirl podcast, I think you were one of the first people who said, hey, if you need guests, I'm happy to come on there and talk about, I think the Speaker for the Dead was the first thing you mentioned, and then Asimov and Harry Potter and other things. But what is it about Speaker for the Dead that put it at the top of that list?
It was Speaker for the Dead is my second favorite book in the whole world. And Ender's Game is my first favorite book. But I figured you would have plenty of people who wanted to talk to you about Ender's Game. And I already have a whole podcast where I, you know, give monologues about Ender's Game. And Speaker of the Dead for the Dead is not one of those books that's nearly as popular, so people don't talk about it as often.
Sure.
And so because of that, I just feel like I have a lot of pent-up Speaker for the Dead feels. But I also felt like it would be something other people would volunteer for. So I was like, I need to claim this first. I want Speaker for the Dead.
Nice.
So yeah, my second favorite book followed by, you know, Ender's Game is my first. And I determine what my favorite book is by how many times I've read it. Like, I keep track.
Yeah, me too.
And so that's how it's my second favorite, because I've read it upwards of 15 times. So, okay. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, this is – so some of my history with the title, I told you that I had a friend lend it to me. And then I bought it in paperback, and then I ended up buying it in hardcover. And then I bought it from my Nook, and I also bought the audiobook. and I've read it in all those formats. And this is with both Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead, actually. And I think I've actually read them both the same number of times, which is funny, because I tend to not read one without reading the other one. And
yeah,
for me personally, actually, I do call Speaker for the Dead my favorite book. And I like it a lot more than Ender's Game, even though I do really, really enjoy Ender's Game. But there's something about Speaker that's just deeper. And so, I don't know, it means more to me, I guess, than Ender's Game does.
Yeah, I think part of it might be, you know, different people's different time of life, those different books will speak to you differently.
It's true. And I'm a bit older than you too, because you said Star Trek The Next Generation came out the year you were born. You know, I was in high school, so.
Right. You know, you come at these books from different angles, right? With Ender's Game, you might be Ender, but Ender is 11. So at some point, you're kind of look at Ender the same way Graf looks at Ender, and that'll be a very different perspective. Speaker for the Dead, you know, when you're 11 and reading it, you are, you know, you're O'Haldo. Sorry, I'm going to mispronounce all the names. But then as you get older, you know, you are Ender or Novena, who are the main characters. So it kind of changes, I think, your perspective. And Ender's Game is super flashy, exciting, and Speaker for the Dead is not flashy. It's exciting. It's not flashy.
Yeah.
So I think that how people feel about them kind of is affected by that. And I know certain people who I know loved Ender's Game, and they're like, what should I read next? Should I read Speaker for the Dead, or should I read Ender's Shadow? And I always have to follow it up with, what did they like about Ender's Game?
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people who hate Speaker for the Dead because it was not Ender's Game, the sequel, which is what Ender's Shadow is. Mm-hmm. And Speaker for the Dead is a very different book. Then I know other people who, like yourself, they prefer Speaker for the Dead. They think it's a much stronger and better book. So it all depends.
Yeah. You had said that Ender's Game was something that your dad recommended to you. Do you go right on and finish the whole series, or did you stick with Ender's Game?
I think there was probably a year where I only knew Ender's Game. And I can't remember how I got a hold of Speaker for the Dead. I might have gotten it. That was probably during the time period where my parents took me to the bookstore once a week. So <Okay. laughs> I might have gotten a hold of it. It depended. I don't remember properly. And I know I didn't read Ender's Shadow till much later. But I don't remember when I first read Xenocide and Children of the Mind, which are the follow-ups. Mm-hmm. I just know I got to Speaker for the Dead not too long thereafter. And I think I read Speaker for the Dead on my second Ender's Game reread, but I can't say for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar kind of story where I read Ender's Game and I had no idea that there was a sequel. And one day I was looking in the library, in my local library here, for books on tape, because I had a car with a tape deck, and came across Speaker for the Dead and saw a sequel to Ender's Game. And I thought, what? And it was a little confusing for me. And we'll get into some of that later, just because of the kind of different setting. And the parts that it takes from Ender's Game are not the parts that you would necessarily think of. And so there were the parts that I had kind of forgotten had happened. And I don't want to go into too much of that right now. But I was glad to take it in on audio the first time, because it is such a different book that's so different in tone that I think the strong narration that was there. And actually, I'm going to drop in at the very end of the podcast, like the first track off of the audiobook, because I think it's really, really well done. And it'll give people an idea of what they might experience if they listen to the audiobook, which I definitely recommend. And I recommend, actually, when I say read Speaker for the Dead, I actually recommend to listen to it, just because I feel like somehow Card's writing really translates well to audio. So
I've only ever read it. I've never listened to the audiobook. I tend to have a hard time listening to fiction audiobooks. Mm. It gives an extra layer of separation that's unnecessary to me. Okay. Cause when I read a book, I don't see words. I see like there's a movie in my mind. And so when I hear an audiobook, there's an extra layer of translation there that makes it harder for me. And usually I'm driving, so I can't imagine what's happening in my mind. So I liked reading it, but I'm going to mispronounce all the names because I've never listened to it. It's just going to happen.
Well, I can provide some help with that, just because I've listened to the audiobook 9 times, and I have a coworker who speaks Portuguese. Yeah. So I can tell you it's Olhado and Novinha and Marcão, but there's actually in my Nook version there's actually a pronunciation guide for the names. And that
there is in my paperback version too. I just, you know,
yeah.
When you read a book when you're 14, you don't pay attention to that, and you just read it, and then these names become these names. And
that
at some
sticks,
point,
right?
They're like fantasy names, right? It doesn't matter how many times someone tells me Egwene from Wheel of Time should be pronounced Egwene. I'm like, no, it's Egwene. I don't care.
I had that same problem when I learned what the pronunciations were in the Prydain Chronicles, which were some of my favorite books when I was a little kid. And then I found out, oh, it's Taran, not Taran. But
yeah.
So you said you have read all of the everything in the quote Enderverse?
I'm not sure I can claim everything anymore, just because there was a new series that came out in the last 3 years that was co-written by someone.
Yeah.
Yes, that I have not read. Okay. I stopped reading with I can't even remember the name of it anymore. There was a book that came out that took place, I want to say, between Ender's Game and...
Ender in Exile is what you're thinking of, I think.
Probably. Yeah. I don't think I liked that one. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of like, you know what? I'm done. And I definitely did not like the last Ender Shadow book, which I think was Shadows in Flight.
Yeah.
I pretty much wanted to burn that book to the ground.
Oh, really?
So I think there's a point where authors need to stop.
Yeah.
They expand things too far and actually contradict their earlier books, and it kind of ruins the earlier books.
Yeah. Definitely.
So Shadows in Flight definitely implied things about the buggers that I found disconcerting beyond what was already disconcerting about them. So I didn't like that, and I didn't like that retcon, and so I just rejected it. But I really like Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow. Speaker for the Dead. I like Ender's Shadow. I like, I actually really love Shadow of the Hegemon too. I really love the Peter Bean dynamic in that. And I feel like with both series, after the first two books, you kind of get a little bit of degradation.
Yeah, you do.
But that's the way these things go sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've read all of the Speaker series and the Shadow series, as I've heard them referred to, and enjoyed all of them. There's bits in every one that I enjoy. And actually, I think on the whole, I prefer the Shadow series, but Speaker is my favorite single book. So, and I actually have read, I read the first three books in the first Formic Wars series, but that was enough to get me to not really be excited about the second Formic Wars series. So, I actually did pick it up and I read a chapter. I'm like, I don't care. I don't care about any of these characters. So
that's kind of how I felt about Ender in Exile, because it wasn't really about Ender. And I was like, I don't care about these people.
Yeah. There is a new book coming out this year, actually, in the series. And I'm not sure I'm excited about it. So
see, I didn't even know. So
yeah, I didn't know until a couple of days ago. So I think that's about it for kind of history of the Ender series that we both have. Cards on the table. I have two dogs actually in the room with me right now, and their names are Ender and Bean. So
yeah. I like it.
And my son was kind of the one who wanted to name them that way, and he wants us to get a girl dog and name it Petra. So
oh, yeah. I approve. My dogs all have geeky names. They're just not Ender's Game geeky names.
Are they all Wheel of Time?
No, only one is Wheel of Time, Galad, and the other is Bucky for Bucky Barnes.
So. Oh, nice. Okay. So, I mean, it feels like we've already been talking about the book a little bit, but let's kind of do the non-spoiler discussion portion. And here, I should reemphasize, this is not non-spoiler for Ender's Game. None of it is. So are you prepared to give kind of an elevator pitch for what this book is?
Yeah, I thought about it, and I'm not quite sure it's elevator, but it's definitely short. So, all right. So over 3,000 years in the future, a colony is established on a planet called Lusitania. Shortly after it's established, they discover a primitive alien race that they nickname the Piggies, who already live there. And after years of the humans studying the Piggies under strict no-interference laws, the Piggies brutally murder the scientists sent to study them. And due to the laws, the humans can't even ask a simple question of why. But young Novena, the planet's resident biologist, she thinks she knows why, and she thinks the blame rests not on the Piggies, but herself. From that moment forward, she'll do whatever she must to hide this dangerous information, even marry an abusive man. Many years later, the aliens again brutally murder the next scientist who studies them. Between these deaths, a Speaker of the Dead is requested by Novena's own children. They wish the Speaker to speak the truth to lay open all the secrets. But to get to the root of the disease that festers in Lusitania, the Speaker must look past this broken family into the Piggies and ask the questions humanity has been struggling with for thousands of years. Can humans and aliens live in peace? And more importantly, how can humans possibly begin to understand the alien other when they can't even understand the broken humans in their own community?
Nice. That was really good. That's like a good like back of the hardcover kind of synopsis, or inside flap kind of thing. So
yeah, it's kind of a query letter, but
yeah, and it touches on some of the themes in the book that we'll kind of circle back to later.
Yeah, I kept trying to get it shorter, but it's such a complicated book. So
it is. Yeah, I was trying to write something down and I couldn't do it. So in terms of Ender's role in it, if you wanted to add something about that, you know, it's he has a mission to complete that he started at the end of Ender's Game, and this book is kind of that for him. But it's also so much more than that, right? It's also him healing from that So
right, I mean, he's got in the words of Black Widow, he's got red in his ledger, right? Mm-hmm. And he's trying to redeem himself from that. And there's one very specific thing he can do, which we know from Ender's Game, which is he can bring back the alien species he's the one who murdered. Yeah. Spoiler for Ender's Game, obviously. You know, it's not. This book isn't even just about his healing. It's about the healing of a whole family. It's about a healing of a whole colony. And I think, you know, bigger picture, it's about the healing of all of humanity for this crime that is just in all of humanity's past that most of them don't deal with at all. They don't deal with it, but they just ignore it. And they say, oh, that's in the past. It was a horrible thing. Let's not even deal with it. As we see with how they handle the piggies, the not dealing with it doesn't work.
Yeah, definitely. So we're not getting a first-time reader perspective on this. And on most of these, we have gotten that because I've been a first-time reader of a number of them. But can you tell me what you thought of it the first time you read it?
There were so many things that attracted me to this book when I first read it. And I think the redemption of Ender, I was very invested in Ender, obviously from Ender's Game. But also, I really love like broken family dramas. Mm-hmm. Of families, like, you know, coming to terms with each other and airing everything out and being stronger and better for it by the end. There's a lot of like movies that I would say fall in that kind of genre of like, usually they're like Christmas movies, right? Or Thanksgiving, sure, where everybody gets back together and then suddenly someone explodes at Thanksgiving dinner and now everybody's crying and they have to deal with all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I also found the whole situation with the piggies, this book is kind of a direct argument against the Prime Directive, which is something I was raised with.
Right, right.
I was raised on Star Trek, and they're very hard trying to obey the Prime Directive, which for those who are listening who are not Star Trek fans, is this idea that you shouldn't interfere in primitive cultures.
Right.
And this book kind of directly calls out that thought. And it's interesting because this book was written before the Next Generation, not before the original Star Trek series, but I would say Captain Kirk only use the Prime Directive.
He played pretty fast and loose with the Prime Directive.
Yeah. it was definitely Next Generation that came in and like smacked you in the face with Prime Directive. So I found that very intriguing to have this completely opposite viewpoint and kind of how the primitive culture might view the Prime Directive, if you will. I don't want to say too much about that because it's kind of spoilery. I just found the whole thing intriguing, not to mention the different just interhuman relationships and the different cultural relationships and how things have developed. I don't think there was anything in the book I didn't like the first time I read it. Yeah. And even now, you would have to, you know, make me hard-pressed to find something I don't like.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same page with you. And so, everybody, just be prepared. We may go a little long here and slobber all over this book. So,
we love this book.
Yeah. For me, one of the things that I really, really loved was just the interesting science fiction in it. And it may be that because I didn't have that base of reading science fiction earlier. Now, I should confess, my science fiction reading was almost entirely confined to Star Trek The Next Generation novels up until I went to college. And I read, you know, dozens of them, but I didn't read really anything else. You know, I read no Asimov, I read no Heinlein, I read nobody. And so coming to this book and the life cycle of the Pecaninos and the life cycle of all the other life on Lusitania was just fascinating to me. And then you add to that the mystery aspect of why did they kill Pipo and Libo? Why would this happen? And then the additional mysteries of you know what's going on with Novenia, why she's hiding things because she wants to protect people from dying. But just that kind of the great science fiction and the mystery aspect of it really, really pulled me in the first time. And I remember noting down, because I don't only track how many books I read and or what books I read and how many times I've read them. I made myself a little database with a web interface. Adult nerd, what can I say? And so I remember noting down in there, I think I liked it better than Ender's Game. And this was just on a first listen through of it. And then every time I read it, I can go back and read my comments and like, yep, definitely my favorite book now. And so it's definitely one that's rewarded rereads. Because even though you know the mystery, it's still great experiencing all of that again.
When you reread it, because you know the mystery, you're kind of coming at it from the piggy's perspective, I feel like. And you're trying to, you know, you're seeing what the humans are doing and just seeing how they're missing the point over and over and over again. Whereas the first time you are the humans, and it's like the next time you're like, I understand the piggies. Why are the humans doing what they're doing? And it definitely is rewarded with rereads, as obviously.
The other part that I really liked is that one part of Ender's Game that, you know, people say it's a fun book, and a lot of ways it is, but Ender suffers in that book. Yes. And so in this book where he comes to that catharsis and meets someone as broken as he is, that's just wonderful as well. And I love it.
I agree. And the thing that's, I've reread Ender's Game and Speaker many times. The thing that's always gotten me about Ender's Game is I feel like the first time you read it, you're just like, oh, that was fun. And on previous rereads, and if you go listen to my podcast on this topic, I will monologue about this in there. There's just things that, like, there are moments of Ender's suffering that at different points in my life I have identified with, right? And it's not his flashy fun times, you know, in Zero G. It's his moments where he looks at his friend and realizes there's a barrier between them, right? And I'm like, I identify with that. And in Speaker, I feel like there's a lot of that because we all have families.
Yeah.
We all have the parents we don't understand or the sibling we don't understand, or, you know, we live in a community that's, you know, I come from a conservative, religious background, not Catholic, which is what Lusitania is, but there's things in that I relate to. Yeah. And so I just think there's a lot in this book, even though it's presumably about aliens, that's really about us humans. And I think that's a great thing Orson Scott Card does with the Ender series, is it's never about the aliens. The aliens are there to tell us something about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's that quote very early in the book at the, I think it's at the top of the first chapter, actually, the quote from Demosthenes, where it says, it introduces the terms of Raman and Varelsa, which we'll get into probably later.
I love those.
and says, you know, when we declare a species to be Raman, it doesn't mean that they have reached some threshold. It means that we have.
Right.
Okay. So if you were going to recommend this novel to somebody, on what basis would you recommend it? Would you recommend it if they're... You've already said, if someone's a fan of Ender's Game, you don't necessarily just go, well, Speaker for the Dead, definitely. But fans of what other books do you think would enjoy this?
I think if you like something like Arrival, the movie, you'll like this. Because I think at its heart, this is anthropological science fiction, which is very different from Ender's Game, which is military science fiction. And I think there are a lot of people who love military science fiction. I do. I eat military science fiction up. Like, I, you know, put me in a military academy and I am sold.
Yeah.
But anthropological science fiction doesn't sell to as many people. It's not as, quote, sexy. But if that's something that interests people, how communities misunderstand each other and trying to figure out what things mean. And I think Arrival is a great example of that. Even though Arrival and Speaker for the Dead are very different, they're both aliens trying to understand each other, right? And that's ultimately what this book is about. But that said, if you love family drama books, this is the book. This is the family drama sci-fi book. You know, you have Novena and her, like, what is it, seven children?
Six, I think.
I don't think it's seven. It's six, yeah. And there is a lot of drama, and Orson Scott Card does a very good job of giving each of the children their own personality and their own role to play. And so if that's the kind of thing that interests you, you'll like this. But if you go into Speaker for the Dead expecting it to be Ender's Game 2, it will not be.
No.
And so you have to come at it with the right expectation, which is why I think people who read it who never read Ender's Game like it, and people who are more open... A lot of people, when they want a sequel, they just want the same book over again. You know, we're all guilty of that. There's a reason why, you know, every Nancy Drew book is the same, right?
Right.
And so, especially for kids, I think, because a lot of people come to Ender's Game as a child. Like, a lot of people read Ender's Game in school. So then they're like, oh, give me the next book. And someone hands them Seeker for the Dead, and they hate it because it's nothing like Ender's Game. So, it is definitely a more adult book for all mm-hmm. that it's not like rated R, other than I guess there's some violence. But it's got just adult themes.
Yeah, definitely. It's a more mature book. And
yes,
I guess I would say if you really identified with Ender in Ender's Game, and that was what you liked, and you liked the notion of him going off into the sunset looking for redemption, then I definitely recommend Speaker for the Dead. And if you're a fan of fiction that isn't fast, because I don't characterize this one as slow anymore, but having, you know, listened to it 9 times and read it 4 times, I know what I'm getting into. And so there's really not any parts of the book that I feel like are slog.
Agreed. But yeah, I'm the person who likes council scenes. Like, everyone's okay. always like, don't write a council scene. And I'm like, I love reading council scenes.
Okay.
So yeah. Give me conversations between people. I love that.
Yeah. I like conversations between people as well. And one of my problem with a lot of fantasy that I've tried to read is lots of the more florid prose describing mountains and journeys and stuff. And I much prefer interactions between characters. So
yeah, and Orson Scott Card is very sparse with his descriptions. He gives you what you need to imagine the world, and then he's like, we're done.
Yeah. Yep.
We don't have to keep talking about how brown the grass is or whatever.
Right. Okay. I think it's spoiler time. So, dear listener, you have been warned. You have 2 very enthusiastic endorsements for this book, and we've probably hopelessly oversold it at this point. Although I think we've tempered it enough, because it's not an action book. You know, objectively, Speaker for the Dead is slower than Ender's Game. But I think it's absolutely worth the journey. So, anything that sticks out? Anything that you really enjoyed or want to talk about?
I really love, and you already mentioned this, I wish the definitions of stranger that were created by Valentine / Demosthenes were in our lexicon. Like, I wish we could use that. Because there's so many times talking about politics or things like that where I want to be like, that's because you're viewing them as an Utlanning instead right. of, your neighbor. And so it's just amazing to have this definition of neighbor, right? Because I feel like it is appropriate to bring up religion in a discussion of Speaker for the Dead, because it's mentioned a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like when the man asked Jesus, who is your neighbor, right? And Jesus's answer is inevitably everyone. But that's really what this question is of how, you know, who is your neighbor? Is the person in the same community as you? Is the person who's basically from another community, but kind of the same culture? And then the mm-hmm. person who's from like a completely different culture. And then there's the person you can't understand at all. Yeah. And I feel like if we had that understanding in our modern lexicon, like, it would be so much easier to have some of these discussions. Like, you know, especially in modern politics, when we talk about how people view I'll use the example of like American Muslims versus, foreign Muslims. And for some people, the American Muslim is part of their circle, right?
Right.
But somehow they're still more foreign. Like there's like the person from another country is even more foreign. And they're, right. and they're the, I don't know how you pronounce the word, the V one.
Varelsa.
Right. To these people. But, you know, even though they're part of the same community, and it's just amazing that if we had these words, I feel like we'd have better discussions. And I wish everyone would read Speaker for the Dead so we could use these words.
I totally agree. I could not agree more, because I think it's very perceptive, too, that when he refers to that, I think he has Miro. Oh, no, maybe it was Wanda. I don't know. It was one of them saying, I wish you had not introduced to them the Demosthenian hierarchy of exclusion. And that's a very interesting way of looking at it, right? Not looking at it as we're defining, you know, how close you are to me. We're defining how far you are. And just kind of flipping it that way and going, this is how we exclude each other. And it totally applies in politics and just in society in general. Like you were saying, like I have coworkers who are Muslim, you know, and yeah, maybe I think of them, well, I know them, they're friends, you know, but all those others. Eh.
Right. So the coworker might be an Atlanning, right? But
right.
the person from another country might be a Framling. So,
right.
or a Brahmin, even, depending on how you view them.
Mm-hmm.
And even I feel like in America alone, like, I feel like our politics, a lot of times people view the other political party as more framling than Utlaning, right? And so it's like they're no longer part of my community. They're not even from the next community over. They're like a complete stranger to me. Yeah. And it's like it would be so much better if we could have these conversations like this. And so I've got to thank Orson Scott Card and Speaker for the Dead for giving us these definitions. I just wish that they existed in higher in pop culture, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish they were higher profile as well.
And it's a very critical part of the book, right? Because the discussion mm-hmm. revolves around, are the piggies Varels or are they Ramen, right? Are they not human but understandable, or are they, you know, just wild animals? And Ender really gets to the heart of that when he talks about why aren't Mira and Wanda more mad that the piggies killed Lebo?
Yeah. If you're not going to hold them responsible for that, then you're treating them not like Ramen, because Ramen are responsible for the actions.
Right. You know, if my dog kills a mouse, like, I don't think anything of it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's kind of how they're treating it. Like, oh, he got killed by a wild pack of animals we were studying. You know, sometimes people get killed by the animals they're studying.
Yeah.
And Ender calls them out on that, and they kind of, you know, they're defensive, but they realize there's a little bit of truth to what he says.
Yeah. This is one of my problems with, you mentioned earlier, some of the sequels to, the Shadow series, and I think even Ender in Exile, where it gets harder and harder for me looking back at Ender's Game to excuse the buggers for what they did. Because in Ender's Game, it kind of puts forth the idea that, well, we didn't know that you were sentient because we couldn't communicate with you. But the more developed the more they develop kind of the buggers, the Formics, the more I think, yeah, but you're smart. You should have known. I mean, you don't come to a planet that has technology on it and go, these people obviously can't think.
Well, I think one of the issues with the buggers wasn't just that they didn't view us as not sentient, is that they didn't realize that each individual one of us was.
Yeah, that's true.
So to them, killing an outpost is basically letting the head queen know, hey, we're here.
Right. Shutting down the communications equipment.
Right. Yeah. So they viewed individual humans more like equipment and didn't understand why we were so sensitive to that, because they had no understanding of something like that. And I think for the buggers and the humans particularly in that case, this is the first time both of them have encountered another species, right? So we've got to offer them as much grace as we would offer ourselves.
True.
At least in that. So...
Yeah, it just the more they kind of talk about in Shadows and Flight in particular, there were some problems that I had with the way the buggers were treated, because I felt like, well, if this is who they really are and they can just communicate with anybody, which they seem to be able to, then I've got a problem.
I think Shadows and Flight really undermines everything, so I don't recommend it at all. Just the discussion of the male buggers, and I don't want to get into spoilers for that book, but everything in that book kind of. It almost kind of presents that maybe we were right to kill the buggers.
Yeah.
Which I don't support. So no. I don't like the retconning of who the buggers are. I like to think of them as a queen with many parts that are all part of her. They're not individuals. Yeah. So
now, when I came to Speaker for the Dead originally, it had been, I think, about a year since I had read Ender's Game. And so I got to the parts of the book where it talked about the Hive Queen and the Hegemon. I'm like, what are they talking about? I had no memory whatsoever of like the final chapter of Ender's Game. I had to actually go back and read it so that I could understand what they were talking about. Because it says, you know, at the end of the book, he looked a long time, and that's where this one picks up when he's looking for a place to bring the buggers back to life. But yeah, it's interesting how much, I mean, You mentioned that somebody could read Speaker for the Dead without reading Ender's Game. And I think there's enough there to let you know, okay, here's this guy who's very old, and you find out eventually who he is. And the fact that he wrote this book to kind of turn himself into the villain, which is crazy.
I think that's Ender in a nutshell, though.
Yeah.
That's kind of how he views himself. He does not forgive himself for the things other people forgive him for, such as the murder of the other kids who he didn't know he murdered, right? Everybody else is like, oh, he's just a kid. He didn't know. And he's like, no, I killed them. Like, he takes that responsibility, and he didn't know he killed the buggers, Right. And I mean, that doesn't excuse him, but it's just like, he doesn't think it's okay. He doesn't feel it's okay. And I think writing it is kind of like, he needs everyone else to understand why he thinks what he did is not okay. Cause everyone else is celebrating him as a hero. And he's like, no, I'm a villain. And they're all like, no, you're a hero. So that's the only way he has to convince them that what he did was wrong. And of course, as we see in this book, it goes completely that his name is a bad word.
Right.
In fact, one of the kids makes a comment when his password is Ender, like, I thought you couldn't use words like that.
Yeah, I thought the computer would reject profanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did that to himself, yes, but he doesn't want to be that. But I, and his redemption, right, is he's trying to bring the Hive Queen back, which is also something he's terrified to do. Right. And that's a duality to him through this whole book. And even the subsequent books is that the buggers are scary.
Yeah.
In a way that the piggies are not, because the buggers look terrifying.
Right.
They are the monster that people imagine when they imagine monsters. They're giant insects. And what do we do to insects? We kill them.
Yeah.
Whereas the piggies are cute and smaller than us and primitive. The buggers are more advanced than us. They're giant alien bugs.
Well, and they're so alien too, with not having the normal means of communication.
Right. And there's very few people they can communicate with.
Yeah. Well, Ender even mentions, too, that, you know, humanity is free to love the buggers now that they think they're all dead.
Yes.
But when they're presented with the piggies, another intelligence that could potentially move out into the stars and not necessarily be a threat, but really be a threat, you know, he says to them, look, they will act the same way we did 3,000 years ago.
And they do, right? It all proves out because the piggies have a bigger weapon than the buggers ever had.
Right.
They have the Descalada. Mm-hmm. Not intentionally.
Right.
But when it comes to us versus them, we always pick us.
Yeah.
We never pick them. And we see that all the time within ourselves, which comes back to this idea of we can't even accept each other. How are we supposed to accept the alien? I mean, just look at how the people of Lusitania treat Ender. Look at how they treat each other. Like Novena isolates herself and they let her do that.
Right.
Like no one tries to reach out to her other than Peepo and Lebo. And so and her husband, to be Mark fair. So, you know, we can't understand each other. The bishop and the children of the mind can't even get along.
Yeah.
And they're the same religion. How are we supposed to get along with these piggies who think the trees are their ancestors?
Mm-hmm.
And the trees are.
Right. Right. One of the parts, kind of Ender being broken after Ender's Game and having that, you know, going back to that final chapter of Ender's Game where Valentine comes to him and says, come with me and let's live forever. And yes. It kind of talks about, and I can't remember if it was in Speaker for the Dead or if it was in Ender's Game. I think it's in Speaker for the Dead, where it uses the term relativistic travel had allowed him to skip like a stone off the surface of time. And so, you know, thousands of years have gone by and his only constant companion has been Valentine. And so now he accepts this call to go to Lusitania and he goes there. And that moment when he's with the Children of the Mind and he realizes the loss of her, even though it's only been a couple of weeks, but he knows it's been 20 years for her, and then breaks down there is just, it's one of my favorite parts in the book.
I love that. And I also love, he turns off Jane.
Yes. That's what I was going to say. It leads to my single favorite chapter in the book, which is Jane. That's the title of the chapter. And I know you haven't listened to the audiobook, but that is my favorite audiobook chapter I've ever listened to. It's a really, really good, narration performance there. And it's fascinating science fiction, the idea of Jane coming to exist and finding Ender.
Yeah. Yes, it's almost like a story within itself, that whole chapter.
It really is, yeah.
And the thing I love about Ender turning off Jane is I feel like it's so – Ender commits the crime he always tells everyone else they're committing, which is they thought something was inconsequential, and to that other person it wasn't.
Right.
And he's always calling people out on that, right? Like, oh, Novena, you didn't think it was a big deal that you stood up for Markeo, but to him, that changed his life.
Right.
And this is that exact same scenario. And it shows that Ender, for all of his preaching, doesn't always walk the walk because he can't, because he's human. Yeah. And, you know, to him, he dismissed an annoying child. And to her, her world ended. She fundamentally changed because of that event in a way that he can't even begin to comprehend. And it changes their whole relationship. And I think there are so many times we dismiss people. And I think that's the lesson in this, right? We dismiss people who needed us. And we didn't realize how big an impact we had on their lives. And to us, they were not as meaningful to us as we are to them. So we're like, I don't have time for you right now. It changes their lives. And, you know, Jane comes back stronger and better. I think you can argue because of it, because she was too dependent on Ender,
right.
I would say. But sometimes, you know, to get to there, what does it say for, like, you know, from her perspective, it was like millions of years for her to recover.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I really particularly like that she goes through and analyzes what he did and compares it to all of his past behavior and says, this was not something that he did flippantly. He was reacting to something that I did. I hurt him. And then he did this, not knowing it would hurt me. We're both innocent. We'll just forgive each other. And then she finds that she can't just forgive him because the damage is real. And that's another fascinating bit there. And it's very real, right? It's very, very believable.
I think that's an important thing for people to realize, right? Because we get pushed a lot to forgive and forget.
Mm.
Or at least I did.
Sure.
And someone does something that, you know, really hurts you. And you're like, you have to forgive and forget this happened. And you can even logically say, I know they didn't mean to hurt me. But it doesn't change the fact that they accidentally stabbed a knife through your back, right?
Yeah.
They didn't mean to set the knife on the counter so you'd run into it.
Mm-hmm.
But you did. So you can forgive them logically, like Jane does. She forgives him logically, but she cannot forgive him emotionally. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't even intend to punish him, but she can't go back to him the way she used to.
Yeah, she takes steps to protect herself against future injury. Now, there are a substantial number of female characters in this book, many more than in Ender's Game. Because you have Novena, you have Novena herself, you have her children, Quara and Ella, and I guess it's just the two girls. Yeah. And then Wanda, who's the other xenologer, and Valentine's
in the mayor.
Yeah, the mayor, Mayor Bosquinha, Donna Criston. And I'm curious, I mean, I have the man's perspective here, right? What do you think of the characterization of the female characters in the book?
I have never had a problem with the females in this book.
Okay.
I qualify that because there are other Orson Scott Card books. I'm looking at you, Petra, and how he changes characters. And I think in a lot of books, Orson Scott Card gets caught up in this idea that females like only exist to reproduce. That is very demeaning, but you don't really see that in Speaker of the Dead, partly because Novena has children.
Right.
And Ella and Quara are just too young to even be thinking about that. And if the mayor has a family, which I think she does, they're just never mentioned, right? Like, they're not important. They might be mentioned in passing. And obviously, the children of the mind have no children.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this lets the women all be real characters, and their motives are not like, I must find a man and settle down and get pregnant. You know, Novena's desire for family and to produce children is not because of some evolutionary need. You can argue it's because she lives in a Catholic community, and this is the way she's raised, right?
Right.
Whereas I feel like in a lot of other of his books, he's like, no, this is a woman's evolutionary need, that if she does not reproduce children, she will languish and perish. But in this book, we just really don't see that. And I really appreciate that. Like, Ella is never portrayed as, even though she's like 18, she's not looking for a man. It never even crosses her mind in this book.
Yeah, she's a scientist, and that's her concern, right?
Yeah, is her science and her hurting family.
Mm-hmm.
Which is siblings and a mother. It's and I think it's a very powerful depiction of women in this book. I don't think it's the same in all other Orson Scott Card books, so I add that disclaimer. But I think in this book, the women are great. I will say the only thing that bothered me in this book, and that's this time, I've become really sensitive to the Socratic method. and Ender uses it all the time. And I really hate the Socratic method. And so I've never been annoyed before by Ender using it. But this time I was like, oh my gosh, Ender, just tell them what you're thinking.
Yeah.
But that's Ender's way, I guess. But it did kind of strike me this time, just because I've had a couple of professors who've used the Socratic method that I really didn't like and disagreed with. And I had I've gotten in arguments where you have guys who are just like, just to play devil's advocate. And I'm like, why do you need to play the devil's advocate? The devil doesn't need an advocate. Just tell me what you think. You know, it didn't really bother. I think it really only bothered me on Trondheim.
Yeah.
When he's teaching that class, but that's just how Ender teaches that class. But
yeah,
I had professors who use the Socratic method and I hated it. I was just like, okay, just tell us.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of his students even says something, you know, people like your sister. She actually answers questions. And he says, well, that's because she has answers and I don't.
Right. And I understand he's teaching like a philosophy class.
Right.
And I guess I've never taken a philosophy class. And when professors use the Socratic method in engineering classes, it drives me up the wall because there is an answer. Just tell me what it is.
Yeah.
So
I got an engineering degree at a liberal arts college. And so I got to take ethics and philosophy. I've definitely experienced some of that in those classes, but not in engineering classes so much.
Yeah, I took engineering classes at an engineering school.
Yeah, yeah.
So you would think there would be none of that, but no, there were some professors who maybe Socratic method is the wrong word, but basically they wanted you to always go back to first principles and derive everything. Therefore, they would always answer a question with a question, trying to get you to derive the lesson for them. And I'm just like, no, just tell me the lesson.
Right. So I had written down some kind of favorite moments from the book. I think the speaking is very powerful.
Yes.
Because Ender's Game introduces the concept of the speaker for the dead. But it's only here that you experience what that's like. And it's really, really fascinating the way he does it. And it's another great chapter in the audiobook, because Stefan Rudnicki, who does the reading, has this very kind of deep bass voice, which I never pictured for Ender, but somehow it totally works in Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead. And I find it very powerful. There's actually a YouTube that has edited it down with all the little sidebar comments out, because the speaking is taking place and then there's things happening in the process where people have gathered. But this video just edits together just the parts where Ender is speaking. I don't feel like it flows quite as well. I've listened to it all the way through, but I might put a link in the show notes just so people can get a look at that.
Yeah, I was actually reading that chapter last night, and my husband kept trying to talk to me, and I was like, I cannot talk to you right now. I cannot, I have to finish reading this section.
Yeah, you can't stop in the middle of that chapter.
No, you can't. You've got to keep reading it, and it's so powerful, and how he turns everything back on the people. Like, right, they come expecting someone to come up there and say what they all thought, that Markeo was a monster. And I think it's very powerful. And I know there are some people, you sent me links.
Yes, I did. I'm battling with myself if I want to put that in the show notes, because I don't know if I want to give it any more clicks.
I think don't give it any more clicks. Okay. But there are some people who view this as victim blaming.
Right.
But I don't think that's what it is. Because Ender's whole thing is you have to understand the other person, and you cannot defeat them if you don't understand them.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way for them to get over this trauma is to understand their father. And I think it kind of goes back to everyone is the hero in their own story.
Right.
Right. And I think we as a society all have we have culpability in the actions of our outliers.
Yeah.
Societies create these outliers, you know, something I felt a lot. And I think this is even mentioned in the book, but briefly, maybe in one of the like essay things, being in a religious organization, when I was single for a long time, I felt like an outsider. I felt excluded. Right. I felt rejected. Was I culpable for that? No, the society was culpable for that, right? And it's not any individual one person. It's a societal crime.
Yeah. In the church in particular. I have a sister who's in her 40s and she's single. And, you know, the church does not do well with single people. It doesn't understand how to deal with people that haven't already gotten married.
It has no baseline for how to handle that. And so it commits these crimes over and over again against these people.
Yeah.
And Ender even says, you know, and this is the Brooklyn Nine-Nine quote, right? Cool motive, it's still murder.
Right.
It doesn't vindicate, it doesn't erase Marcao's guilt.
Right.
He is still guilty. He did these things. He beat his wife.
Yeah.
It is no one else's fault. He beat his wife. It's his fault because not everyone has to become a monster from the horrible things done to them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still society treated him horribly.
Yeah.
And it's like a cycle of crimes we committed against each other. And I think a lot of us, we just want to demonize the bad guy. We want to say, no, he is bad. You know, he is Darth Vader. He's cooler if he's just evil.
Yeah.
But, you know, Darth Vader has a reason for getting there. The prequels didn't
execute
well. But, you know, every villain has a reason. That doesn't make what they did right. And it doesn't make anything they did right.
Yeah.
But understanding and saying what they did is okay are completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can understand someone and say you are a horrible person and you deserve to go to jail forever.
Right. Yeah. Well, so the other part of the article about the victim blaming was Novenia blaming herself and taking the beatings from her husband as punishment for what she perceived as her guilt, right? And the guilt over the death of Pippo and Libo and the guilt over everything else that had happened. And, you know, that's the way he drew the character, the way Card drew the character. But I still don't see that as blaming the victim. It's the victim blaming herself.
I also think that's a very Catholic guilt.
Yeah.
I've talked to some of my friends who grew up Catholic about this. And I'm like, is this real? Like, do you blame yourself for things that go wrong? Like, do you punish yourself? And I think not all, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Not speaking for all of Catholicism, but I think there are Catholics who they really make that guilt a part of themselves. Like everything that goes wrong is their fault, right? And so they have to pay penance. Like confession and penance is a part of Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, usually the penances are not marry an abusive husband.
Right.
Yeah. Usually they're like, go pray, maybe do some community service,
mm-hmm.
you know, healthy things. Your priest is there to help you. But Novena doesn't feel like she can go to the priest, so she feels like she has to pay her own penance. Like, we cannot separate these people from the fact that they are very Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And to do so is to undermine their whole culture. Whether Novena believes in God or not, she grew up in a Catholic community, and that is ingrained in her system.
Yeah.
So I think it's very realistic. You know, it's like the kid who blames himself when their parents get divorced.
Right. Yeah.
Is it the kid's fault? No, that doesn't mean the kid doesn't blame themselves. Their parents got divorced.
Yeah.
So I think it's very real.
Yeah.
I wish someone had helped her much earlier, but this goes back to the idea of the Lusitanians' crime against her and that they isolated her from her young age.
Yeah. She isolated herself too. And they allowed it to happen. And Pippo, you know, to his credit, was one who noticed it when she was younger, that I didn't do enough for the girl.
Right. And I think that's a very communal crime, right? Because that goes back to this idea of singles in the church. It's the exact same thing the church does to single people. The church isolates them, you know?
Yeah.
And so did Novena isolate herself? Yes. But the community allowed it to happen.
Yeah.
You know, they could have gone to her. They just didn't.
Yeah. That's one powerful moment in another one of my favorite parts of the book where Ender rows down the river and talks to Ella about science. And I love all of that because I love all of the science fiction about the weird life cycles on Lusitania and the weird evolutionary patterns and stuff. And
I love the Descalada.
Yeah, me too. I think it's fascinating. I don't think that what they do with it in the rest of the series is as interesting.
Agreed.
But I think there's a lot of Deus Ex Machina in at the end of Xenocide, but whatever. But when he's speaking to Ella and she tells him about Miro being banned from the house for a year, and that when Libo dies and Miro is welcomed back into the house, and that she hears him crying in the middle of the night and she doesn't go to him, and she says to Ender, I think I should have gone to him. And he basically says, yes, you should have. And the idea that there's something powerful in accepting the fact that you did something wrong and that the something that you did wrong changed you as a person, and that now you wouldn't do that again. But you have to recognize that you that happened in order to move past it. And that's something that, you know, as I'm a Christian as well, and so the idea of confessing sins, you know, and why it's powerful to talk to someone about what's going on in your life is because when you say things out loud, it makes them more real.
And I also think that's what the bishop is missing from the speaking, is because he's like, this should have been done privately, but the bishop agrees, you know, it should have been aired, right? But
right.
privately. But when we only do those things privately, we miss the communal guilt that everybody has. But yeah, I really love that sequence with Ella. And I also love in the beginning when she's attacking the speaker and she doesn't know why.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's a very teenager thing.
Yeah, she's just defending her mother, right?
Yeah. She's like, I want to be your friend. And somehow, like, and it's not that she even disagrees with him about the stuff he's saying about her mother. It's just that instinctual thing that you're like, this is my mom. You can't say these things, even if they're true.
Yeah.
And it puts her on the wrong foot. And she's like, how do I come back from this? Like, we're supposed to be friends, not enemies. And of course they do. Yeah. But I think we've all had those conversations where, you know, if Ender was less Ender and Ella less willing to try to fix it, it could have ended there.
Yeah. I like too that there's a, the outworking of that whole conversation is when she goes back home and Keen finds out that Oliado had been helping Ender and to get into Novenia's files. And he starts yelling at him, and Ella says to him, you know, stands up and just smacks him down and says, I say that helping the Speaker for the Dead is an act of loyalty. And Oliado just bursts out in tears because he loves him. And now, you know, he's, someone else is telling him it's okay to love this guy.
Right.
And that's very powerful to me as well. And actually my favorite moment in Xenocide is when, Valentine comes from Trondheim and she's older and she goes and meets all of, Novenia's children. And when she's talking to Oliado, he's the only one who hasn't gone into sciences. He's like a brickmaker or something. And he's got a bunch of kids. He has decided the best thing to be is a good father. And he tells her, when I'm alone with Ender, I call him Papa. And I just love that. It tears me up every time now. I'm an old softy now. So
That's always spoken to me. I always thought that was the best part of Xenocide. I'm not sure it forgives the rest of the book, but
no, the book is too long.
I find Xenocide to be a slog.
I do too. Yeah. I've only read that one in print once. So, and the audiobook is not good because one of the character voices is one of the Chinese characters, and the white lady who does the voice does it all in English. And it's
painful.
It's horrible. It's insulting is what it is. So, which is sad because she's normally just fantastic. So, and she's very good in Speaker for the Dead.
So, we've gotten this far and we haven't really talked about the piggies.
Yeah. Go for it.
So, the things that I really love about the piggies is how they view the Prime Directive, which we've talked about a little bit, but they view it as we are denying them. We're holding back the bread and giving them stones, right? Is I think what they say. We're going to take over the universe and leave them behind. We're not sharing with them. We're bad neighbors. Yeah. they can cross the fence and see everything we do. And yet here you have these, Xenadors who aren't supposed to tell them anything. Mm-hmm. And when Ender comes in and just starts like directly asking them things and how Mira and Wanda are just like stunned.
Yeah.
And when they learn what they did to Lebo and Peebo.
Right.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. They tried to honor them and found out, I think Manda Shuva says, right? I tried to honor him and I killed his tree forever.
Right. And it's just this complete miscommunication because we try to fit their evolution and life cycle in a Earth-centric model.
Right.
And that they are completely alien. So it completely breaks down.
Yeah. It never crossed their mind to think Rooter really is talking to them out of his tree.
Right. I mean, it even takes Ender a while to realize that when he knows the Hive Queen is talking to someone.
Yeah.
So, cause it's just beyond the realm of what they think possible that these animals could become trees.
Yeah.
Like you don't go from fauna to flora.
Yeah.
So, and of course, the fact that the Xenadors and the biologists don't talk to each other, even though Miro and Ella live in the same house and could talk to each other.
Right.
But
well, they don't collect tissue samples from the piggies either. And that's right. That's one of the problems. And this is actually, this leads into one of my kind of, I think it's a goof, but maybe you can talk me out of it. When Novinia pulls up the simulation that she shows to people, and then people sees it and he rushes out, which I think is an amazing scene, just the suspense that it builds up, and they go out and find him, and they say it says they found him all too soon, and the piggies hadn't even planted a tree in him.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a great twist. But she shows him something on the screen, and then she shuts it down and locks all her files. And when she's thinking back to what she showed him, she says that it's something about the Descolada's patterns in the nuclei of piggy cells. That's what the book actually says, even though it's been made clear that they can't collect tissue samples.
I think it's got to be a mistake because they didn't have a tissue sample.
Yeah. Either that or that's just the way she's remembering it, but
it could be Cabra.
Yeah, I suppose. But she was doing comparisons of all the native life and finding out that the Descolada did specific things in everything because that's what Ella was working on.
Right. But, you know, they have all these knowledge and Ella's working on it, but she can't even imagine that it's the grass that's pollinating the cabras. Right.
Right.
Because animals don't get pollinated.
Right. Yeah. Or the reeds mating with the snakes. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, you know, they tried to move the grass and it died, they even mm-hmm. say. So it's just so foreign a concept. And this ties right into when they go to meet the wives. And Ella and Wanda immediately want to save the little mothers.
Right. And let them grow up.
Right. And Ender's like, you don't have the right to come in and change this culture.
Yeah.
Not like that. It's their decision to make. And I think that's the fine line in the Prime Directive, right?
Right.
In that kind of thought. Because, I don't want to say that the Starways Congress is all evil and they're just trying to suppress the piggies.
Right.
I think they're honestly thinking, no, we need to let them develop as they're supposed to develop. Honestly, I think they should have just not let the Lusitanians – they should have evacuated the Lusitanians immediately.
Yeah, probably. Because any contact between them was going to change the piggies just by the very nature.
Right.
Just knowing that there are other aliens out there. Other beings in the universe, that's a major shift.
I mean, it's like what Ender says, right? The interaction with the buggers is what leapfrogged humanity forward.
Yeah.
Just knowing the buggers had this technology is what led us to create the technology.
Yeah.
Why do we have Ansibles?
Right.
Because the Hive Queen doesn't need an Ansible.
Right.
She can talk to her people instantly across any distance because that's how she works. They're all just parts of her. It's like it doesn't matter how far away for your foot is as long as it's connected to you. You still can move it.
Right.
But we still developed the Ansible because we said the buggers must have something that lets them do this. And if they have something, we can have something.
Yeah.
So it's inevitable. And I honestly don't know why Starways Congress let them settle there.
Yeah.
But once you do settle there, what can you give them and what can you change and what is too much of a change? You know, what has to be their decision? And that's a fine line. And I think obviously changing their whole biological process is not something we should change. But that seems kind of obvious, right? Like you shouldn't go in and start mucking around in people's genes unless they ask for it.
Sure.
But, you know, were they right to give them Amaranth?
Yeah. Well, they saw it as a moral decision, right? Not a scientific one.
Right. And that's the question. You know, when does morality and science overlap and how do we let those things? And I don't think Speaker for the Dead presents any answers.
No, not really.
And when Ender interacts with the wives and he has to be both respectful of their culture, but make them respect his. Right. Because he's not there as an anthropologist. He's there as an ambassador.
Yeah.
And he says that, and it's like mind-blowing to Ella and Wanda, because those are different things, right? Mm-hmm. What is it to be an anthropologist versus an ambassador? To get a good treaty, both sides have to recognize the other as to be human-centric, human.
Right. Ramen, yes.
Yes. So if you don't, it's just going to fail.
Yeah.
And the treaty only works because the buggers exist. Because that's who arbitrates against, you know, humans and piggies. It's the buggers. Who arbitrates between buggers and piggies? It's humans, right?
Yeah.
Only having this triumvirate is the only thing that will allow it to work.
Yeah.
Which I think is an amazing concept.
Yeah. I do adore the entire sequence where he's negotiating the covenant with them. And just the interaction between Ender and human. I love that. I love that where Ender realizes the price that's going to have to be paid, right? That he's going to have to take a life, even though he knows it's not murder. And he expresses that to human, you know, you talking to you now face to face like this, this is the way that's real to me. But with you as a tree, you're like a grave marker, you know, and then human says to him by way of comforting him, you know, just come and sit in my shade and rest your back against my trunk. And I think that moment's wonderful. I still have quite a few things written down. We've been going a while.
It's a great book.
Because I wanted to talk about, I mean, we've kind of been mixing in themes and that kind of stuff. I usually kind of have it split up between plot points and themes, but I think this book, it's hard to split between
those. This is a thematic book.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. The whole idea of the speakers for the dead, I can't say I'm totally behind the idea, where he says basically the only doctrine they have is that if an act was good or evil lies entirely in the intentions of the person who did it. And I don't think I can agree with that. I think the opposite of that, right? Giving no credit to intention is also wrong. But I don't think that all the judging of the morality of something based on intention is correct. Does that make sense?
I think it makes sense. And I think this is a book that was very formative for me. So I tend to put a lot of weight in intentions.
Yeah.
But that said, I do agree that sometimes your intentions don't matter. Yeah. And strangely for this, I like to go to the example of Frozen, the movie.
Oh, really?
Which I'm sure everyone has seen. Yes, there's a scene in Frozen where Anna and Elsa are in Elsa's ice castle. Mm-hmm. And Anna is confronting Elsa, and Elsa gets upset and she accidentally freezes Anna's heart.
Right.
Did Elsa intend to freeze Anna's heart? No.
Right.
But it almost resulted in Anna's death.
Right.
It did result in Anna's death. Anna was saved by magic. So I don't think intentions can always save you. I think it makes it easier for Anna to forgive Elsa because she knows Elsa didn't intend it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't change the fact that Elsa was almost a murderer.
Yeah.
and I think sometimes it's hard for us to – sometimes we go too far one way, right? We're like – this act is clearly only ever evil, and no good person could have ever committed this evil act, yeah. Right? So if you commit this act, you are, by definition, evil. And I think sometimes that's taken too far. Because we're all human. We all do bad things.
Yeah.
And I think these are questions. The thing that I think makes Speaker so interesting is, as I was rereading it, is I was like, these are questions I see people debating on Twitter now.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is a very, like, conversation people are having all the time right now. And I feel like that says a lot that a book that was written 30 years ago can speak to today.
Yeah.
And it doesn't answer these questions, like we said. It just makes you think about them.
Yeah, totally. So one other thing that I had written down, and we've already touched on it, right? The hierarchy of exclusion, right? Where you've got Utlanning, Framling, Raman, and Varelsa. Which I find very fascinating, but kind of along those lines, you look at the 100 worlds as presented in the Ender series, in the Speaker series, and the worlds seem to be monocultures, where it's Lusitania is all Brazilian, right? Path is all Han Chinese. In some sense, I kind of go, well, we value diversity now, at least, you know, like in the workforce. And so I can't see that happening. On the other hand, like, I walk into my work cafeteria where we value diversity. Even though you will find people from different cultures sitting together, largely people tend to group up into their own groups. And so I guess I've kind of answered my own question. I guess I can kind of see things going that way, where everybody of a certain culture might choose to just all live together.
Well, I think this is something that's hard for us as Americans.
Yeah.
Because we live in the quote-unquote melting pot. No matter where you've lived in America, odds are you met someone of a different race. I lived in places that were very white, and there, you know, like maybe only three black kids in the whole school, but they were still three black kids in the whole school, right? As opposed to, I know someone who is of Asian ancestry, but was adopted into Belgium, and she never knew anyone else Asian.
Oh, wow.
Right? Like, she lived in Belgium. she lives in America now, so. you know. So if we got space travel and all the different countries got space travel and got the opportunity, I think some of the countries would be like, pick a country.
Finnish.
Finnish, whatever, right? Like, I'm going to take a bunch of Finnish people and go to a Finnish world. And it's not that you're not invited. It's not that you can't come there. Other people can come to Lusitania. It's that we founded a Finnish world.
Yeah.
So it's going to be like Finland, but in space. So if you want to live there, it's Finland, but in space.
Yeah. You can see it sort of on the small scale, too, with the United States. When you look at the history of settlements, right? Where if you go to North Dakota, right. Or, you know, Minnesota, those areas, you're going to see a lot of Scandinavian looking people because they kind of moved en masse. But in general, in the United States, it's a little more diverse.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's just it's inevitable that people want to preserve their culture. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think the way the Hundred Worlds gets away with it is that their science and their literature are informed by diversity because they get the science and literature from everybody's world.
That's true. And having instantaneous communication really does help with that as well.
Right. So they are able to feed off of each other. They may live in China or, you know, a Bipath, right? Mm-hmm. Which is based off of a very particular Chinese culture.
Right.
Because China is not a monolith.
Right.
And they still get stuff from Lusitania should they want it.
Mm-hmm.
And that informs their science and their literature and their work. They can work with people on other worlds via instantaneous transportation, via the internet, basically, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, instantaneous communication, not transportation. So I do think that probably still leads to this even, you know, this whole – Utlanian framling thing, right? Like Ender is very much viewed as a framling when he comes to Lusitania. And I think anyone who came to Path from anywhere else would be viewed as framling. And I think if there's like, you know, England planet, and you're not British and you show up there or English particularly, like, you know, you better believe, I think that if Wales gets the opportunity to form their own planet, they're totally going to do it, right? And so you get to Welsh planet and you're Polish or American or Chinese, they're going to be like, you're not Welsh and we all speak Welsh here. And yes, they also all speak Stark, but it's hard, you know, Ender, even being as able to communicate in Portuguese as he is, it's still hard for him to get around.
Yeah.
So I think it's very real, but I think we'd also see, I also think we'd see not just cultural segregation like that, that's based on ethnicity and planets. I think we'd see like there's an art planet where like has the best art school and all the artists want to go there. That is where all the art is done,
right?
You know, or like an engineering planet where this is the forefront of, you know, faster than light travel is done here. So if you really wanted to input into that, you would have to go there. And I think we would see, because we see that here, right? Like we see that in America, that there are certain cities that are known for certain skill sets. And I think there are people who are willing to leave behind their people for their passion.
Yeah.
So, you know, there'd be the Hollywood planet or whatever, right? And I think that would also happen. And so in that, I think you'd get more diversity on those planets because it'd be people from all these different cultures saying, I want to direct movies.
Right.
And this is the planet where you direct movies. Not that you can't direct movies on those other planets, but Hollywood movies are considered higher level than everybody else's, right? So, right.
Yeah. The other ones are the indie planets, right?
Right. It's like, oh, look at Path. They made a cute little movie.
Yeah.
And Orson Scott Card doesn't really go into that. And that may be more of an Asimovian kind of thought, what with Trantor. But I think we'd see something like that.
Yeah.
You know, even like I live in New Mexico, you know, do I really want to live on a planet that has no concept of salsa, right? Like,
right.
I spent a summer in France, okay? They tried to sell me something they called that was a quesadilla and there was no cheese in it.
Whoa.
But I'm like, can I live in a place that has no New Mexican or Mexican food?
Yeah.
Because they're not the same thing.
Right.
So... You know, those kinds of things, right? What's a comfort food for one person's not for another. So it would be really interesting to see what happens. And I think all of it is dependent on how space travel becomes available.
Yeah. Well, Anything else that you want to bring up and talk about? I have a couple other kind of just for fun topics, but
I'm good for anything. I just like to talk about anything in this book. Okay. So I love this book. Everyone should read it.
Yeah, I totally agree. So one thing I like to look at is under the category I called wild speculation, where speculative fiction, you know, science fiction, where they kind of swing and miss. And lots of times this is in like 50s era stuff where they didn't imagine wireless telephones, you know.
Right.
In this case, there's not a lot of it. There's a criticism that I've seen of Speaker of the Dead that says, okay, look, this is 3,000 years after Ender's Game. Where's the new tech? And I don't know how valid that is. Certainly on Lusitania, there's not a lot of new tech. But I think that's kind of understandable as a colony planet. But the one thing that I feel like, if he wrote this book today, he would have to contend with more sophisticated satellite technology.
Right.
Because the satellites that are there in the book, you know, there's some imaging, but I don't think there's the idea. I don't think he successfully predicted just how detailed satellite imagery could get. And the other side of that is something even smaller and more personal, drones. You know, is it how far in the future are we to drones that are indistinguishable from suck flies on Lusitania?
Right.
That could be used for studying the piggies, right? If you have that technology, then all of a sudden there's a very different book, right? Because the xenologists have more data in their tool set. And so I wouldn't want to put that in there, and I'm glad the book is the way it is, and I'm totally fine with it. It's just, it's when you look at it from now, you're like, well, how come they couldn't get more information? How come they couldn't see what the piggies were doing?
But I think we have to give Orson Scott Card credit for foreseeing what he did.
Definitely, yeah.
Because he foresaw the internet before most people knew the internet was a thing.
Right.
And
tablets.
Like that everyone would have a computer. Yeah, tablets. Yeah. Everyone would have a computer. Everyone would have a sign-in. He definitely imagined a more regulated internet.
Yes.
Especially in Ender's Game.
Yeah.
But this idea that the computers are designing computers and that the internet runs itself is a very real idea.
Sure.
And we have that now. So we read that now and we're like, yeah, that's the way things are. But he wrote this in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember the 80s and we did have a computer, but it didn't compute much. So.
Yeah. And you know, him and Ulhaldo are playing a game that like I can imagine people are playing right now somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like he predicted a lot of stuff as it is. I do think Lusitania would be gifted the best technology that existed just to study the piggies.
Yes.
If there was like little suck fly drones, like some scientist on some other planet would send it to them.
Yeah.
And maybe we can argue they haven't been there long enough since the piggies were discovered, since everything else is so far away, so that technology is still on its way.
Yeah.
So they only had the technology that would be in any random colony.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would think they would have tiny little drones that could just go in there and see what's up with the wives.
Or even little fake Masios that get eaten and pass through the digestive tract and collect tissue samples on the way down.
All right. How hard is it to collect a tissue sample?
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, I accidentally rubbed against you, Reuter.
Right.
With my gloves.
Well, or, you know, Reuter is flayed out there on the ground, right? There's blood spatter everywhere. You're telling me that nobody brought back blood on their shoes?
Right, right.
So maybe that explains the piggy cells, but it's not explicit. So
no. So I think there was more that could be done, but I think that of the books that I've seen that commit crimes against the future in technology, this is not as
it doesn't rank no
as many others.
No. Although I will say that the idea that the password for Ender's files is five letters. And
well,
more or less a dictionary.
Jane was
word.
Also protecting all of his files.
That's the way I retcon it, right? That Ender is the password that he types in that Jane recognizes. Yes, okay, that I'll let you in, but I'm going to make you type that first, because he wanted him to type that, or he wanted Olliato to have to type that, right? And on the backside of it, she's got like the data from the next generation fractal encryption code on it. So that nobody can get in.
Well, I mean, she keeps track of everything, right? That's what she says. She has many layers of intelligence, and we can't even imagine. So, I mean, she's watching Ohaldo put this in. She knows it's Ender getting into his file system. And I have to imagine if anyone else tried, even if they had the password Ender, she would be sitting there watching them knowing that that's not Ender, right? Yeah. I mean, she messes with people just to mess with them sometimes. Like, she is literally aware of everything everyone's typing into their computer at any given moment. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's easily retconned.
I don't really have a problem retconning it. I just found it funny, so... Especially given, you know, at work, like, I have to change my password every 8 weeks, I think. And it has to have...
And then I forget it.
Yeah, exactly.
Has to be 15 characters, have your, you know, blood type and your firstborn child given away. Yes.
Precisely. So, since I've read this book a number of times, I always... And I've read the entire series a few times, or at least, like, on audio. I always notice the little dangling plot threads that I know don't get actually wrapped up in the series. And the biggest one for me that I notice every time I read Speak for the Dead is Sifta, who's Valentine's oldest.
Yes.
Who at some point after Ender leaves, before he arrives at Lusitania, you know, she says, I'm going to go and help him with his work. And I don't think that's ever tied up anywhere in the series.
I thought she came to the planet with her parents, but she's not really a character.
No, he loses track of her. You know, at that point, I think there were just too many characters to probably keep track of.
Yeah, but Pleaked is far more of a character than Sifta, and I think that, it was just too many characters.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like they should have left her on Trondheim.
I do too, yeah. There's one thing that I really like about the book, something that the book does well, especially on rereads, is when you read the little dialogues at the beginning of each chapter, kind of like in Ender's Game, but they're always excerpts from something in Speaker for the Dead. And the first time that you read one that says, you know, I can't remember what it is, you know, about the trial in absentia of the Zonologers of Lusitania, you're like, ooh, stuff's about to go down on Lusitania.
Of the treason of Lusitania.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, Demosthenes' book on Lusitania. And you're like, what? She's not even there.
Yeah. Yeah. I like those little tidbits that are kind of played out through the book. A little Easter eggs that you could, I'm not sure that you really noticed the first time through. Even the little things about, you know, like, and this isn't from the beginning of a chapter, but the first time that Reuter says, I love to climb trees, I can see everything. And that kind of gives you the idea, you know, the trees do give them an interesting vantage point that the humans may not be counting on with their fence, where they can, they can see over the fence. And actually that's made explicit in the graphic novel which I picked up last week, and I do not recommend. I didn't even know there was a graphic novel. I knew that there was an Ender's Game graphic novel, but I picked it up, and I don't know, the art didn't thrill me, and it's so hacked up. I'm too attached to Speaker for the Dead to really like any possible adaptation of it, I think. Even though my other podcast is all about adapted science fiction, and I tend to be the one who says, no, I want to see changes made to it. I want to see it improved. Speaker of the Dead may be one that I couldn't really separate from. So on that topic, what do you think? Is it possible to adapt Speaker for the Dead?
I think it's possible. I think we would have to... I think a movie like Arrival makes it more possible. Even in Arrival, they felt the need to add a little explosion, flashy that was not necessary. But they would have to accept that what they're making is a family drama.
Yeah.
That's going to be something more like The Family Stone than it's going to be like Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's a family drama that a member of that family happens to be some aliens.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I kind of look at it more in the line of, well, this is, you're not going to be able to edit this down to 90 minutes of movie. I'd rather see it done as a series. Of course, I'd like to see Ender's Game done as a series as well.
Yeah, and what they did with the Ender's Game movie does not give me confidence.
No.
Not because the Ender's Game movie wasn't a good movie if you divorce it from the book, but the Ender's Game movie completely missed who Ender was.
Yeah.
When Ender accidentally kills Bonzo instead of purposefully killing him, I'm like, you just undermined his whole character.
Right.
Like right there. That you just missed who Ender is completely.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't give me a lot of faith, like, that they could do justice to something like this.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think that they set it up very well either. The distances weren't right, you know, in the way things worked. Valentine didn't go with him at the end.
Right. He left directly from the military. So I have so many problems with that movie. Yeah. I can't even.
Yeah. He didn't do the time, right? He didn't become the guy who would become the Speaker for the Dead.
Right. I don't even think he wrote Speaker. He didn't even write the Hive Queen and the Hegemon.
No, no, no. Because of course, he hadn't written that until he was, you know, 20 years old or something.
And they completely erase Ender and Valentine's whole storyline.
They do.
So,
yeah.
Like, it leaves no place to set up. They couldn't even go into, like, Ender's Shadow series if they wanted to, because they completely erased Peter as anything more than a childhood monster.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I also don't think that they'd be able to do justice to Jane, and I think Jane is an absolutely critical character to Speaker for the Dead.
Agreed.
So, I also think they would horribly whitewash the movie. I don't think they'd go, let's just get a bunch of Brazilian people.
Why don't we film this in Brazil?
Although Brazil is you know, it's not, not everybody in Brazil looks the same.
Right. But this series does particularly call out Brazilian, Catholic, mostly darker skinned.
Yeah, it does.
Brazil is a diverse place of many races. Mm-hmm. But this is a particular subset of Brazil. I even think when most people think Brazilian, they think Hispanic, and I would say that's probably not even who the Lusitanians are.
No.
They neither speak Spanish,
yeah,
nor are they, they're black. So
right. The funny thing is that my coworker who is from Brazil, his parents are Korean. He's Korean. but he was born in Brazil and his first language was Portuguese. So
I had a friend who was Jamaican, but of Chinese ethnicity. So,
oh, wild.
It's always fun to when you have people have these expectations of what someone from that place looks like, right?
Yep.
And you're like, nope, some of these places are more melting pots than you expect.
Yeah. When my wife and I were in Japan, it was almost 20 years ago, we went to a restaurant that was called the Down Under, and it was an Australian lady who had moved there and started a restaurant, and all her wait staff spoke English, but with Australian accents because they were learning it from her.
I love it.
Yeah.
We need more Australian accents in the world. I support this.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. I think we're about done. I mean,
we've been talking like 2 hours. Yeah, I know.
I'm going to try and edit it down to under 2 hours. I think we went almost an hour and a half with Michael because he had a lot to say about Dune, and so did I. But I figured this one would go long. I do like to look at like the competition for the Hugo in 1987. And I have not read any of the other books.
I looked at the names and I'd never even heard of them. So I've got to go with they chose the right book.
Yeah, I think so too. The only reason that I've heard of Count Zero, which was William Gibson, is it's the sequel to Neuromancer, which I talked about with Lisa last month. So that's the only reason I even recognize that one. Other than that, I'm like, I recognize a couple of the author names, but yeah, I think they chose the right one. Well, final thoughts. What more is there to say?
I think this is a very unique book. I think there's not a lot of other books like it. And I love it. I mean, there's a reason why I've read it as many times as I have. Mm-hmm. And even this time I was putting it off. I was like, somewhere in my mind I had built up like, do I really want to read it again? And then like, as soon as I started reading it, I had read like half of it by like, you know, 3 hours later. So, because I just forget how engrossing it is.
I have to thank you for choosing this one because I hadn't read it in a couple of years and I still, if people ask me what's your favorite book, this is the one I would say. And so I was really glad to have the excuse to go read it, even though I have other things to read.
Yes, you just always have to avoid the temptation to go into Xenocide after Speaker for the Dead. Because after I read it, I'm always like, a Xenocide can't be as bad as I remember.
Yeah.
And then it always is.
I won't say it's bad. I enjoy it, but it's definitely more of a slog. And there's a lot of inconsistencies between it and Speaker for the Dead, particularly with Jane's ability to talk to someone who's in close to light speed travel.
Yeah.
Because it says explicitly in Speaker for the Dead that she loses track of Ender when he's traveling. And then in Xenocide, she's totally with Miro the whole time. So
maybe she's upgraded her software.
Maybe, yeah. But yeah, there's moments in each book that I really, really love, but there's not as many moments in Xenocide. I think Children of the Mind is a slightly shorter book, and just it has the virtue of being the final book in the series, final-ish anyway.
Yeah.
And so you always get kind of a bump from that in terms of, oh, I liked that it wrapped up that story. But I'm perfectly fine recommending to people just read Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead, and you're good.
Stop. You know,
yeah. Well, Mandy, I really want to thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. I love talking about books.
Yeah. And I'll keep you in mind down the line if I need a guest again. I know that you have other things that you'd probably be happy to talk about.
I love books.
So where can people find you?
I like live on the internet, so they can find me in lots of places. I'm on Twitter at @brown_Aja. That's AJAH. I have a website, www.apself.com, though that tends to actually be more theology.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I teach middle school Sunday school and post all my lessons.
Oh, cool.
And I am also on Tumblr at the-feels-assassin. The Feels Assassin, yes. And yeah, obviously at Trivially Crucial, that's our podcast, Michael's and mine. So you can definitely find me there. Cool. And of course, I'm always on Twitter and Tumblr.
I'll put links to all that in the show notes.
Yeah. Come talk to me about nerdy things.
Cool. Well, again, Mandy, thanks so much for doing this. I hope we get to do it again sometime down the line. I'm kind of booked up for the rest of the year, almost. I've got I'm only doing this once a month, and so that gives me plenty of time to read a book and still have other books that I read. But for anybody out there listening, I'm going to be talking to Jason Snell next month, and we're going to talk about The Diamond Age from Neal Stephenson. So that'll be another reread for me, but it's only a second read, so that one should be fun. Anyway, Mandy, I hope to talk to you again sometime.
Me too.
So bye.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Mandy, and I definitely encourage you to go check out Trivially Crucial. I'll put links to everything that Mandy mentioned in the show notes, so be sure to go and check that out. Like I mentioned, the next episode, I'll be talking to Jason Snell of The Incomparable, and we're going to be talking about Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age. So that is the assignment for next month. I've also mentioned that I'm pretty much full up on guests for the rest of this year, but eventually I'm going to need more guests. So if you are out there and you would like to come on this podcast, feel free to reach out to me. Or if you know somebody that I should talk to, another podcaster, send me their information and I'll get a hold of them. But if you want to get a hold of me, it is feedback@hugospodcast.com. You can also go to the website, hugospodcast.com. There's a contact form there. You can reach out to me that way as well. You can find me on Twitter @HugosPodcast or Facebook, facebook.com/HugosPodcast. And of course, if you like what I'm doing here, then I would like to humbly ask you to go and leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher or however you get podcasts and, you know, share, retweet. And of course, you can always just let me know you're listening or give me your thoughts on the title under discussion. That'd be great, too. So any way you want to reach out to me, I would love to hear from you. And one other quick thing before I sign off, I did mention earlier that I'm going to drop into the end of this podcast the very first track on the audiobook for Speaker for the Dead. I think you'll enjoy that. So it'll just give you a little flavor of what that audiobook's like, because I really do recommend the first time for this book, listening to it on audio. Even though if you ask me, does audio count? I would say no, but for this book, it totally does. So be sure to stick around and check that out. Okay, so that'll do it for this time. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye.
In the year 1830, after the formation of Starways Congress, a robot scout ship sent a report by Ansible. The planet it was investigating was well within the parameters for human life. The nearest planet with any kind of population pressure was Bahia. Starways Congress granted them the exploration license. So it was that the first humans to see the New World were Portuguese by language, Brazilian by culture, and Catholic by creed. In the year 1886, they disembarked from their shuttle, crossed themselves, and named the planet Lusitania, the ancient name of Portugal. They set about cataloging the flora and fauna. 5 days later, they realized that the little forest-dwelling animals that they had called porquinhos, piggies, were not animals at all. For the first time since the xenocide of the buggers by the monstrous Ender, humans had found intelligent alien life. The piggies were technologically primitive, but they used tools and built houses and spoke a language. "It is another chance God has given us," declared Arch-Cardinal Pio of Bahia. "We can be redeemed for the destruction of the buggers." The members of Starways Congress worshipped many gods, or none, but they agreed with the Archcardinal. Lusitania would be settled from Bahia and therefore under Catholic license as tradition demanded. But the colony could never spread beyond a limited area or exceed a limited population. And it was bound, above all, by one law. The piggies were not to be disturbed.